fellow travellers, and welcome to podcast 179 in our series, You Should Have Been There, with me, Simon Calder.
And me, Mick Webb. And this week, our guest is someone who we would all like to have accompany us on our travels, Dr. Jane Wilson-Howarth, who is a GP zoologist and a renowned authority on travel health. And we're going to be talking about Jane's new book, Staying Healthy When You Travel, Avoiding Bugs, Bites, Belly Aches, and More. Welcome to You Should Have Been There, Jane. It must be quite difficult to decide what to include and what to leave out of a book on travel health.
Yes, absolutely. And every edition seems to get fatter and fatter because obviously ordinary health problems crop up while you're overseas, as well as the tropical stuff and the scary insects and so forth. Yeah, so it feels like a bit of an encyclopedia these days.
Well, I've enjoyed it ever since Bugs, Bites and Bowels, which I carbon date to having been published in, I think, 1995, 28 years ago. I think you were seven and I was five, if I'm not mistaken. In that time, obviously, I think people have become far more aware of the risks of travelling, I hope, through this book and other things, but also more people going to more places. And I was absolutely terrified by one statistic, page 13, preparations. If 100,000 people visit a resource-poor region for a month, half of them will get some kind of illness, 8,000 will visit a doctor, 5,000 will be confined to bed, 500, that's I calculate 1 in 200 will require repatriation by air, 300 will be admitted to hospital during their trip or on return, and 1 will die. Well, I'm not going anywhere, frankly.
Well, we must get behind the figures with you in a sec, Jane, but do bear with us while we highlight some comments from listeners.
Of course.
And here we have Rebecca Halpern. What would we do without her? She's been in touch on the subject of just-in-case items, the things that you put there just in case you need them and very often don't use, as it turns out with Rebecca. Even though I pack minimally, I always take some paper and pencil with me, with the vague intention of doing some sketching of any nice views, but it never happens.
Pete has also contacted us, and Pete says both coffee and peppermint tea bags. Inconceivable to think of traveling without morning and nighttime survival drinks. And I gather from that probably Pete actually does pack these just in case, but also actually uses them.
Yeah, well, quite. I'm not sure if they count as just in case. Jane, have you got any just in case items? I mean, I presume the physician's life is full of just carrying around lots of stuff just in case.
I'm kind of not very good at that, actually. Lots of people come up and say, have you got a paracetamol, Jane? And it's never me that's got paracetamol ready. But I like to think I've got my just-in-case things include Steri-Strips, with these little wound closures, because I'm always bashing into things and bleeding all over the place. So and they don't take up much space. I have some in my handbag all the time.
Well, This mighty volume, which is just absolutely riveting, 320 pages of what you need to worry about, but more particularly what you can do about it, just takes you everywhere from whether or not you should actually be going, through what preparations you need to take in the form of jabs and so on, and then the things that can get you while you are abroad. But interesting, Jane, that most people will think of maybe rabies, maybe malaria, obviously a horrible, horrible problem. But actually, it's road accidents and drownings. And if you're in the US, unfortunately, murder is more likely to put pay to your travels.
Yes, indeed. And I think that's the trouble, really, that people do focus on the scary things like venomous snakes and don't take sensible precautions like wearing a helmet when they get on a motorbike, because some places you can ride a motorbike without a helmet, so people don't. So it's kind of the obvious things, but also trying to emphasize that there's a lot you can do to survive, And actually, although those statistics you quoted at the beginning, Simon, are scary, they could well be biased statistics, because it's very difficult to know who travels and what actually happens to travellers. And obviously, the worst end of the spectrum is what alerts everybody to what's happened. And those of us who travel and are perfectly okay probably won't appear on the statistics at all.
Anyway, on happier notes, can I ask you, I'd like to refer back to the Steri-strips,
yes,
because I wonder what you would actually advise a traveller to take as a first aid kit, because it's obviously, depending on where you're going, important to take some things. And there are obviously some things like, let's say, defibrillators, which you probably can't take with you. So what would you sort of have as a kind of minimal first aid kit to take with you?
Well, as you say, you need to tailor it to what your activities are going to be and how remote you're going to be, because obviously most destinations there will be a nice little pharmacist on the corner of the road who can provide almost everything you need. Steri-strips don't seem to be very widely available, though. Good crepe bandages don't seem to be very widely available. Those nice stretchy bandages you can use when you wreck your ankle, but are also quite good if you get bitten by a venomous snake.
Is that right?
And I also...
tourniquet so if you, thing?
So tourniquets are dangerous after snake bite because you cut off the circulation, and there's actually, I think, statistically more damage done by... inappropriately applied tourniquets than the venomous snake itself. So what you're supposed to do is, if you're, say, you're bitten on the ankle, you wrap up the bitten part with a crepe bandage. So it would be the whole of the foot and then up to where the bite site is. And if it's, you know, your thigh, you need a lot of crepe bandage. But I mean, most people don't get bitten on the thigh; they get bitten on the lower leg. And that compression reduces the spread of venom and gives you a chance to get help and anti-venom administration.
Well, look, let's focus on what you have spent your entire working life, obviously making people better as a GP, but also doing what you can to keep them safe through your many books and indeed broadcasts. So I'm going to, let's say, Lao. What am I going to do in advance, and when am I going to do it?
Now, off the top of my head, I do not know what the vaccinations necessary for Lao are, but I would certainly have a look at this wonderful website called Fit for Travel, and you can click on the country you're going to, and it'll tell you what the malaria risk is, which I think is present there, and it'll tell you which malaria prophylactics are appropriate, because this obviously changes. You know, sometimes there's, you know, if there's a particularly bad monsoon, the picture of where is malarious can change. That certainly happens in South Africa, for example. So you look on there, and then that will also tell you if there's a current outbreak of dengue fever, or if there's some other strange disease you've hardly heard of. And then you can click on another bit of the website and find out about that disease, or you can read about it in my book. So I think the most important things are probably thinking about how you're going to prevent mosquito bites, because obviously mosquitoes spread both dengue and malaria, and they also itch and you scratch and you put yourself at risk of wound infections. So I really like this product called EX4, which is an insect repellent that you spray on your clothes, and it remains on your clothes through washes. So you can actually cover up with, you know, nice, comfortable cotton clothes and not get bitten.
Okay, can I just check? It sounds as though mosquitoes are travellers' enemy number one.
Probably the travellers' enemy, the preventable enemy, I think. And obviously not being, as we mentioned, sort of being sensible about risk assessment. So if you want to do something that seems a little bit dangerous, then you just eyeball the facilities and see if they, you know, if they're you know, for example, if you're scuba diving, you know, you try and find out whether the equipment looks all right and has been checked properly. And, you know, it's the sort of stuff we don't think about in the UK because everything's so carefully managed. But if you try dangerous sports, bungee jumping or whatever, it may not be quite so carefully managed in some destinations.
What about things like local food and water as threats? I mean, you do say in the subtitle to your book, avoiding belly aches, and originally you had bowels in there, but it's the same idea, isn't it? Is that something we should be extremely careful of, or do you think people are kind of over paranoid about not eating street food, for example?
I think it partly depends on your travel experience. I think as you travel more, I think you probably get less. I don't know how much it's to do with experience and avoiding high risk things, or whether you do. I think you probably do build up a bit of immunity. But I think particularly if you're an inexperienced traveller and first time to resource poor destinations, it's worth being really careful about uncooked food or cooked food that's been hanging around and has got cold, so pies and things like that. And the things I always avoid are lettuce, because that grows at ground level, and the stuff that grows at ground level can get people go out into the fields when they haven't got toilets. I don't want to be too specific,
right?
things get splashed up.
I think.
Foods that have got crinkly bits in them that are difficult to wash are worth avoiding.
Ah, okay. And the all-inclusive hotel buffet. Now, I'm not a particular fan of this, but you get vast quantities of food which sits around on a very warm day, while lots of people help themselves in varying degrees of hygiene awareness. So talk us through the hotel buffet and what we should avoid, perhaps the entire thing.
Okay, so perhaps I should tell you about the infective dose of bacteria. So most bacteria need to get into you in tens of thousands, but things like Shigella, which is the cause of bacillary dysentery, that's the one that has you going 20 times a day. That, if you swallow 10 bacteria, Shigella bacteria, 50% of people swallowing 10 bacteria will get the screaming squits. So it's all about numbers. So if someone has been a bit unhygienic in the kitchen, and it's more likely to be in the kitchen perhaps, and they put their thumb in the soup or the and they put in a few Shigella bacteria, and it's a nice blood temperature. It's maintained at blood temperature perhaps it's put out at 11 o'clock in the morning, and you're eating it at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Those 10 bacteria will have multiplied and have a lovely promiscuous party, and you will definitely get an infective dose of bacillary dysentery or whatever. So anything that's maintained at blood heat for a time is likely to be dodgy. So I think ordering a la carte, if you can, is a good idea. But sometimes if you order a la carte, you'll see the waiter going to the buffet and taking stuff from the buffet and putting it on your plate, and you think it's a la carte and it's not.
So street food that you can see being cooked in front of you and with a high turnover is presumably better.
Is brilliant, yes. And often classy hotels are more dangerous places to eat than, pulling something out of hot oil on the street side. Yes, indeed. So it's and often there's rather squalid places you can eat at bus stations where there's very fast turnover of food, and it doesn't smell very nice, and there's sort of stink of diesel and perhaps urine. Often that those places are great because the turnover is so fast that you're okay.
Jane, have you ever thought of being a restaurant critic?
I think I'd get the sack very rapidly.
It's got a lovely bouquet of diesel and urine. And I love that. Could we come a bit closer to home, Jane? Is there anything much to fear from a journey to Europe these days, other than, and this is the experience of my most recent journey, which was to the northern Costa Brava, where actually no local people drank the water, and it did taste utterly disgusting, but I'm quite sure it wasn't actually dangerous.
So lots of people are very worried about water. My grandmother used to say that going down to Cornwall, it was the change of water that upset her stomach. So, but generally, people don't drink water that is dangerous. You know, wherever you are, they try to get the best water quality possible. But I don't think your Spanish water would have actually upset you. But clearly, if it tastes disgusting, that's not great. Because if there is an outbreak of waterborne disease, I mean, the outbreaks of waterborne disease are very uncommon. And most gastroenteritis actually comes from poor food handling, so poor food hygiene. And if there is an outbreak of, say, typhoid in the Canary Islands, it will be all over the newspapers, and they'll rapidly, the public health boys will get onto it and sort out the source, and it will be sorted. So, so people do spend a lot of money on water purification equipment. You know, sort of 200 quid on some clever device that is. It's probably not necessary unless you're someone who's traveling, you know, you've recently had cancer treatment, or you're traveling with very small children. You can usually get safe drinks and maybe get boiled water if you think the supply is dodgy. So there are places. So, for example, I keep banging on about Nepal. The tap water in Nepal is a bit dodgy because the piped supply is intermittent. And although the water supply at source is perfectly good, because the piped supply goes on and off, it sucks stuff in from the soil around the pipe, and it can get contaminated between the distribution centre and the tap. So I think in places where the piped water supply is intermittent, it's worth being very careful, and perhaps adding drops of iodine or filtering or boiling. But generally, it's the food hygiene that you need to pay most attention to.
Although Simon and I often talk on this podcast about our legendary trips to the Pyrenees, the High Pyrenees, and often there you find you haven't actually managed to carry enough water to see you through the day.
Sure.
And I think Simon is fairly gung-ho about drinking from mountain streams, and I absolutely won't, because I once read somewhere that if an ibex or a mouflon or something or an izard had died further upstream, you would be in serious trouble if you drank the water. But do you think Simon's right?
I think you're overcautious, Mick. I would certainly drink from a stream, and in remote places, I'd be more inclined to drink from a stream than take piped water from Kathmandu, for example. But having said that, yes, it is worth eyeballing the stream and see if, because I was in Ladakh with a local nurse, and she was saying, oh, the most delicious way to eat the chocolate we've got is to dunk it in this glacial fed stream. And she was squatting down to soak the chocolate. And I said, do you want to have a look upstream, Tashi? And there was a dead sheep about 3 meters away from where she was soaking the chocolate. So we went upstream of the carcass, and that was fine.
Go upstream of the carcass. I think that's a very fine piece of advice.
Well, especially in the mountains, because you say very bluntly, page 198, mountains kill a lot of people. Although falls and other accidents are the major killers, ignorance about mountain sickness makes a significant contribution to the risks.
Yes.
Now, Mick is we had a little local difficulty in Cusco in Peru. What should Mick have done apart from not go there, which would have actually made my life easier as well?
I am subject to mountain sickness quite clearly. I have read, and you could actually corroborate this or not, that this is just one of those things that some people are much less good at dealing with, I suppose it's low oxygen environments than others. Yeah, and this gives you, I can tell you, it was the worst headache I have ever had. It actually felt as though someone had taken a machete and put it right down the middle of my head.
It sounds like you need to, have you ever tried using acetazolamide, which is also called Diamox?
Yes. In fact, Simon went out to a local chemist and just paid a few dollars, which I don't think I've reimbursed him for, in order to get this stuff over the counter, which I'm sure is a prescription drug here, but obviously isn't in Cusco, or certainly wasn't. That seemed to do the trick, actually.
I think it's a wonderful drug. So. And generally, as long as you're not allergic to sulfur-based medicines, which is a fairly unusual allergy, the most of the side effects are harmless.
Is there any sort of guide as to about what altitude you should be thinking that you might get symptoms of altitude sickness?
You tend not to get much trouble under 2,500 meters.
Yeah.
And 3,000 meters symptoms are very common indeed. It also, as you've observed, is very dependent on individuals. And some individuals can get sick every time they ascend, and others it's quite unpredictable, and that's what's dangerous about it, really. But I think the other thing is that you should actually perhaps read up on the symptoms of altitude sickness, so that when you start to get symptoms, then you can go in hard with your medicines or descend. Because if you get down as much as 500 metres, the symptoms will probably settle without medicines.
Well, that's interesting. Well, yeah, next time... I will take due account of all of that. I wanted to go back to your book, Jane, and ask you whether for this edition you found that climate change has sort of brought about any changes in bugs and diseases. Have they sort of moved around much, or is it not obvious that the warming and in some places the chilling of the planet has had all sorts of consequences?
That's a really good question. I think the climate change is changing the pattern of disease very much. I mean, we had malaria in this country until about 1920. So we've got...
Oh, really? Gosh.
We've got five species of mosquitoes that are capable of spreading malaria.
Ah.
And whether malaria can persist in a country is to do with the length of the bite season. So a mosquito will only bite before she wants to lay her eggs, and most mosquitoes can lay eggs every 10 days. And the statistics, which I'm hopeless at numbers, say that the more she bites, the more likely she is to spread malaria and maintain it in the community.
Oh, I see, yeah, yeah.
So if you've got good public health and people go to the doctor and get their treatment quickly,
yeah,
then it won't persist. But with longer summers, there will be new areas where mosquito-borne disease becomes more of a problem. And also, I think the other problem is that we're travelling so much more that importing diseases from one country to another, is becoming a problem. So, of course, the Zika problem, which nobody had heard of Zika when I wrote the first edition of Bugs, Bites and Bells, but now it's become very widespread.
Must keep an eye out for that. What's the worst, if you don't mind telling us, the worst medical problem that you've had while travelling? I mean, either personally or that you've sort of found yourself needing to treat in a fellow traveller.
Oh, gosh, if you've got all three of those, I could give you a long list. my two personal worst scenarios were I got stung by a scorpion in Madagascar. Oh. And I was the medic. And people were looking at me with sort of rather fearful eyes, with the look that, oh, the doctor's going to die. So that was quite unpleasant, actually, being eyed up in that way, that they didn't know what to do, and I was out of it because I was in so much pain.
What did you do?
I gave myself some opiate painkillers. Yeah. I was about 24 hours in quite a lot of pain, and then it faded away. So that was quite weird. The more frightening, because I think when you're the victim, you're not necessarily all that aware, was in Pakistan, where my toddler, my oldest son, came. He's a very bouncy, hyperactive little toddler. He came screaming into the bathroom, and the bathroom floor was wet because it was marble, and he slipped over backwards and cracked the back of his skull on a marble edge. Because you know what some of these bathrooms are like. Yeah. When you're travelling, they don't have nice rounded edges. So he sustained a skull fracture.
No.
Although I didn't know, suspected, but didn't know it at the time. But he was not really conscious for, I think, probably nearly half an hour.
Wow.
And a sort of the visceral reaction of your own flesh and blood. And I was thinking, oh, now what do we do? We were up in Hyderabad, which didn't have any kind of decent medical facility. And I knew what needed to happen then was, if he bled within his brain, he would need someone to drill holes in his skull, which I didn't have the kit to do that. It's not something I have in my handbag. And so we ended up driving down to the Aga Khan Hospital in Karachi.
Was that miles? Is that a huge distance? Or?
It was only about 2.5 hours.
Quite enough.
But in the middle of the night, and then one of the other expats said, oh, you're going to need money. And he pulled out an envelope full of used rupees notes. So we had cash. And then we went down to the Aga Khan. But he was absolutely fine. Didn't need boreholes drilled in his skull. And we came home 36 hours later, none the worse. But it's that awful, you know, when something like that happens, you realise how you really, really want a very nice hospital just down the road, please.
How true, yes.
And I think however medically qualified you are, there are certain situations where you just need good evacuation. So the other thing that is worth emphasising, I guess, about to travellers is there are some balmy people who travel without medical insurance, and the medical insurers are amazing for coming in and sorting you out if you have something awful like that happen. And they also have advice lines, so you can talk to a medic who will understand the situation in the country you're in and know where the best hospitals are and know whether you're going to need to be evacuated or whether there is a good hospital that you can trust. And that's worth a lot of money, I think.
Well, Jane, it's been absolutely fascinating talking to you. Thank you so much for reminding us of the essential need to be aware of your health when you travel. And there is nothing better to help you do that than buying Staying Healthy When You Travel, the new edition. Of course, we would love to hear your stories of your best and worst medical experiences abroad. You can, of course, leave us an audio message at anchor.fm/you should have been there. Or why not send us a tweet as they used to be called, on X, formerly known as Twitter. Our address at You Should Have BT.
Yes, thanks so much, Jane. As a fully paid up hypochondriac, I would have loved to have carried on talking to you for many, many hours, but I'm sure you have better things to do. So thanks so much. And till the next edition of You Should Have Been There, from me, Mick Webb.
And me, Simon Calder. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Take care.